This episode is brought to you by the McDonald's 1-2-3 Dollar Menu. It's hard to have a friend who's a slow eater, because when you finish your McChicken sandwich, watching them finish their McDouble cheeseburger and small fries can be excruciating. Until they notice you staring and offer up a few fries. That must be what friends are for. There's a deal for every moment on the McDonald's 1-2-3 Dollar Menu. Get a McChicken sandwich, McDouble cheeseburger, four-piece chicken McNuggets, or small fries for just a few bucks. Prices and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any offer or combo meal.
This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, isn't it about time your printer got smart too? Now printing is smart with HP Plus, and the HP Smart app is how it all happens. You can print from your phone with just a tap, no matter where you are, even from your garage / home office / yoga studio. Huh, that is smart. HP Plus. Learn more about smart printing at hp.com/smart.
Welcome to the Washed Up Emo Podcast. My name is Tom Mullen, and as always, Raymond Harkins is with me, and with a special guest, very, very, very special, Eric Richter from the band Christy Front Drive and the 101 Golden
people
City.
People feel like that. You and my mom.
Well, actually, I want to quickly say how this kind of came about, because, like I said, I, as everyone kind of knowing from this podcast and Ray and I meeting through music, I was into this music and just went to shows, and randomly, I don't remember when this was, maybe 2002, I can't even remember, a friend that I had knew that I was into Christy Front Drive, and she knew you, and we went out to a bar, and I remember hanging out with you, and I remember me obviously nerding for a while, but then asking, what record were you listening to that got you to make the music that was Christy Front Drive, and you told me Buffalo Tom. What did I do? I bought Buffalo Tom records the next day, and then however many years later, you're playing the reunion show at the Bell House, and I go up to you and remind you, and obviously you're super nice, and went and chatted, and I said, hey, we should hang out at this Jeff Bridges thing. Your girlfriend did not believe us.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, no, we're gonna go to the Lebowski Fest. So anyway, from that, to have you on the podcast and have you DJ one of the emo nights, it's just great to have you here, and I'm excited to kind of chat about the old days.
Oh yeah, me too. I love the old days. I find them better than the new days. I don't know. They just seem better because I was young. But
I would love to kind of the formation, and I mean sort of the 5-minute story on just Christy Front Drive and the scene in Colorado, and we're gonna get to a lot of stuff from that, but I just really like to be kind of hone in on that and how that kind of came about and where you came from to start that.
Wow, that's a big question. I was just obsessed with music from a kid, to the point where like my mom was very worried about me as a kid because I was obsessed with Kiss, and you know, and this was like this is preschool, you know. I had an older sister, and her friend lived across the street, so they were introducing me to the band like Kiss, and I was like, when I was a kid, I was just like, holy shit, this is the coolest fucking thing I've ever seen. Like, these guys are wearing makeup, and like, you know, and like, they're kind of like, at the time, it's funny now, because when I go back and listen, I didn't realize all the sexual innuendo they were doing, you know, like, but I just thought they were the coolest fucking thing I've ever seen. And, you know, I was hanging up Kiss posters on my wall. And then I luckily came at age at a time that, you know, I was kind of at the beginning of MTV, too. So, like, I would sit around at home as a child and watch videos all day long. You know, like, whether it be, like, David Bowie or even Michael Jackson or, like, I wasn't a huge Michael Jackson fan, but I did enjoy the videos as a kid. But I remember being really excited when Def Leppard came on or you know, just like, you know, there was so much stuff. And then, you know, as time went on, like, MTV actually had a lot to do with it in some odd way, because it was like such a great outlet for a kid in the 80s when they actually used to play video, you know, that like you would see so many different artists. And that's kind of basically how I came into, you know, in contact with a lot of music. And I still listen to a lot of it. In fact, I still to this day love NXS, because I just remember watching those videos and they were so fucking cool, you know, like, but just, and also just wrote great songs, you know, to me. Like, and that's the thing is, like, my thing is, like, I love a great melody. And a lot of these bands, you know, there was a lot of great bands in the 80s that just wrote amazing melodies and stuff that would just stick with you all day. But I was so obsessed with MTV at one point that I could actually almost, like, predict what videos they were going to play every hour, because they became so formulaic. I can't talk right now, but pronounce this word for me, Tom. What?
Formulaic.
Yeah, I'm really bad. Yeah, thank you. But I have a hard time with that. I used to say photography for a long time. But, and that was actually from the back of a Duran Duran record. But I just grew up, like, obsessed with music, you know, to the point that it's all I thought about, you know. And once, you know, then all of a sudden, like, you know, you had, what was the metal show?
Headbangers Ball.
Headbangers Ball, which, you know, there were different versions. You know, like maybe early on, and even in Denver they were. But then, and then we had, you know, Sunday night when you'd have the, it started off like the IRS Cutting Edge. Do you remember the IRS Cutting Edge?
I do not.
And if you like, it, the first like independent, like, you know, like it was like this indie show was like called the IRS Cutting Edge, and they would play Cure videos all night, and just the whole time I was watching MTV in that time period, I was exposed to all these amazing bands, you know, like the Cure and like. And then they would even start getting into, like, early Britpop. And it was just, every time you turn on the television, you're like, holy shit, I've never heard of these bands before. You know, like, from all over the place. Like, you know, the Trash Can Sinatras and Ride and Swerve Driver. And it was fantastic. You know, like, and that's kind of where I came from. I just was obsessed with watching bands. And, like, just really into, like, just watching. Like, I just thought it was such a cool thing, like, my whole life, you know, from an early age.
I think you. Oh, sorry. No, you're perfect. Because I think you hit on something that is insanely important. Because, I mean, Tom and I are of an age where, I mean, we remember Headbangers Ball. But I think something that was, you know, big for myself was like 120 minutes, which is exactly.
I'm not cutting you off. Go ahead. Finish.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's exactly the same. It served the same purpose, where it was like. I remember, you know, one night it's playing Rage Against the Machine, and then, you know, the next night they'd be playing My Bloody Valentine, and it was like, you know, your musical palette, while at that very moment I liked Rage Against the Machine way more than I like My Bloody Valentine, but it just exposed you to, it just exposed you to a lot that, you know, now
and
it's like...
And 120 minutes was like is what came out of that IRS Cutting Edge, which I guess IRS had money and MTV at one point. But like there used to be like that was what that turned into. And then have that Adam Curry guy with the mullet come on and start like hosting it. That yeah, that's exactly it. Like I mean, 120 minutes was huge because that was like all these bands that I fucking loved. Like they like Superchunk videos and Dinosaur Jr. videos and you know Firehose videos. And it's like holy shit, this is the best show ever.
How did that kind of transition you into independent culture at all? Or was that just kind of, you know, outside of that?
I don't know. Independent culture, like, that was another thing altogether because, I don't know. I think it just happened to meet a few people that were, like, kind of turned me on to that. My cousin was a huge influence on me in a lot of ways. So I went through every phase of, like, music. I went through a thrash metal phase where, and there weren't really phases because I still actually listen to all the music. I still listen to Testament and, like, Slayer records, like, all the time. It's not like, once I like something, because that's one thing I don't understand with people. I don't understand how you could like something and not like it later. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, you either like it or you don't. And then I still like all that stuff. But I had a cousin that, like, brought a Dead Kennedys record over to my house, you know, and I was like, holy shit. And I remember that, and he also brought it over the first Minor Threat, you know, like the... Not the 7 inches, because we were too old. Yeah, I mean, we weren't young enough for for that. But I remember hearing the first Minor Threat, like, you know, the one with his brother on the cover, Ian McKay's, and I just being like, holy shit, this is fucking insane. You know, like, this is like, I've never heard anything like this, you know. And then from there, I bought my first copy of Maximum Rock and Roll, and then started getting into everything, like, started getting into Nicky Breakgun and all these other different bands. And, you know, it's just like a progression. If you're really interested in music, you'll just follow it, you know. And it's a never-ending roller coaster, just, like, fun, you know, to me. Like, you know, I just love, you know, unfortunately, things have gotten, like, less fun lately, but as a kid, I felt like I grew up in a very interesting time of music, you know, where, like, there was just so much shit going on, you couldn't even fathom what was going on at the time, you know, like, Minor Threat, to, like, even The Cure, like, there's so many great bands. I mean, there was this huge, in between the two, I mean, there was just so much in between, you know, like, and I just love music so much in general, that, like, I just was taking it all in, you know, like a fat kid at a buffet, you know, but, you know, that was my whole thing.
Did you always know that you wanted to, you know, kind of play in a band after you became exposed to that?
I was into the idea of being in a band. Like, I used to put on shows in my room as a kid, you know. It started off, like, I wanted to be in Kiss, and I would do these shows. I put on Kiss records, and I would, you know, pretend I was in Kiss for a while. Then it turned into, like, I remember hearing The Vapors. I remember when Train Japanese came out, and I was like, I went out and bought that record, and I was into the whole record. I didn't realize they were ripping off the Jam the whole time, but it was just kind of big. But, yeah, I was always, like, I always wanted to be in a band. But now that I'm in a band, I realize what I was thinking at the time was, you know, was completely, like, made no sense, you know, when I was a kid. But my parents bought me this Buddy Rich drum set, and I would sit there and play, like, anything from, like, Steve Perry, like, you know, we're trying to figure out the drum beat. Just that Steve Perry song, the "Oh Sherry," you know, like, and just, you know, anything I heard of MTV at the time. But, you know, I was just constantly obsessed with music, I guess. And that's kind of where I got to the point, and I've probably gotten off the subject, but, like, that's kind of where I got to Christy Front Drive, because I was just constantly trying to just play music in some way. And then we had such a great team in Denver that, like, we just kind of ended up, you know, you just find four people, you know, three other people that want to play music with you, and just whatever happens, happens, you know. I guess that's the answer to that question. I'm sorry, I went way off.
But, no. I mean,
I was too early in the beginning.
No, like, that's fine. No, I think, that was awesome.
It
I
all
just
started my parents who wouldn't take me to the circus. You know, like,
well, I think just when you know, meeting the other guys and starting it and going, when you guys met and, all right, this is what we're going to do. This is what the band is. Take us back to that time, because now, I mean, honestly, like, so many people, even when I got into you guys, you were already broken up. I had maybe known about you for 6 months, and then I realized you broke up. And I think a lot of people have that same experience. So I think at that time, in that moment in Colorado, like, meeting those guys, what was the feeling and how did that come about?
Well, Christy Front Drive came about from, I went to high school with Ron and Jason. They were younger than me, so when you're in high school and someone's younger, they're not as cool, you know. So, like, they were, like, starting these little bands together, and I was in this band. The first band, remember the band they heard me in was, I was in a band called Lillowatt and a band called Turnkey. I was in a band with older people that I met from, actually, the first band I was in, it started because I wrote back to this kid in Maximum Rock and Roll, who, this kid, Steve Revitt, who was, like, one of my best friends, just wrote, like, I'm into Bad Religion and Green Day and blah, 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 and, like, let's start a band. So, I was just,
that's awesome.
A lot of it, Maximum Rock and Roll was, like, huge. I mean, like, at the time, like, I just saw this ad in the back, and it was just like, oh, this kid in Denver wants to play music. So we started Lillowatt, and then we started this other band called Turnkey, which was a complete Drive Like Jehu ripoff, because that was right when the first Drive Like Jehu record came out, and I was like, we're doing this. You know, like, whatever they're doing, we're doing it. and then those bands broke up, but then, so they were, like, these younger kids, you know. I probably graduated at that point, but, like, you want to come over and play? And we're like, I was like, okay. when I come over, like, I need some place to store my aunt anyways. And we just started kind of playing, because they really wanted to be in a skate rock band for some reason. I remember that. And I thought it was cute, you know, like, their little band was cute. And they always, for some reason, maybe looked up to me because I was older. But so I would go over and jam with them, and then eventually, like, we just started writing songs. And they had started another band with Terry, who was, you know, the bass player, obviously. And he just showed up one day accidentally because he thought they were supposed to be practicing, and showed up and was like, "What the hell's going on here? You guys have another band?" I was like, "No, we're just practicing," you know. Like, he was actually kind of pissed, I felt like. But we're like, you know, because he was a guitar player, but I'm like, we have two guitar players right now, like, grab the bass and play with us, you know. And that day we ended up writing like three songs. And just, it was like one of those like magical moments where, like, holy shit, we should keep doing this. You should just keep coming over and we'll keep playing. And that's what happened, you know, basically. And then all of a sudden we pretty much had that first EP written in, like, you know, probably like 2 months, you know.
Sorry to interrupt, but like, it's interesting because you guys, since, like you said, the goals, you know, you didn't collectively come together being like, hey, we would like to sound like, you know, bands A, B, and C. It sounds like you had sort of, you know, an idea, and then the other guys kind of had an idea. Like, how did you arrive at the sound that you guys did? Especially just because...
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
But we were listening to the same stuff, though. Like, I mean, at that time, we were really... You know, I was really into Superchunk at the time and Jawbox. I was always buying, because I went through this big Lookout time, like this. I was one of those Lookout kids where I bought anything that came out of Lookout from the early, like, Sam I Am stuff. Even like Jawbreaker. I remember I got that for a Christmas gift right here. And but Carrie was definitely someone that came from the outside. I was like, I know those bands too. And we started, like, this off with that. Because I think a lot of, like, our first shows, we would even play covers. Like, there was a great band from Portland called Cracker Bash. And we covered one of their songs. And we actually did a Superchunk song, one of our first shows. But we were just really into that type of music at the time. Because at the time, it was really a great time for that type of music, you know. But, like, when the first Superchunk, because I remember someone telling me, go buy the No Pokey for Kitty record. And I remember, like, being blown away by it, you know. Like, it's like, holy shit, this is a fucking great record. And Carrie actually was like, have you ever heard the Archers of Loaf? And I was like, no. You know, like, and then I remember hearing that, like, whoa, you know, like. So we were all on the same page in that way. So, you know, it was easy to, like, come up with a sound, you know. Even though it was really, like, when I listened back, it didn't really sound necessarily like those bands, but that's where we were coming from, you know. Just all, like, you know, Lookout Records and Discord and whatever band was cool at the time, you know. That we thought were cool at the time, you know. Silkworm is another one. But it was just lucky. We were on the same page, basically, and just started writing songs.
I mean, it's so many... I just, you know, I was kind of thinking back because I knew you guys had the anthology CD, but all those kind of came from those 7 inches. And, you know, one of the 7 inches you guys did was with Jimmy Eat World. And obviously that's, you know, a great thing to do early on. You know,
well, they weren't that, you know, at the time,
they were
like
a punk band.
Weird band from Arizona.
Yeah.
And actually, when we first heard them, like, when I first time I heard them, they sounded like No Effects. They were like, we were like an LA punk sort of thing, like, but in Phoenix. But then they changed their sound and then they just became amazing. But we met them on our very first tour because Jim and his friend decided that they were booking shows in Arizona, and we sent them the first 12-inch. I'm like, can we play? You know, back then you would send the 12-inch out, like, please give us a show, you know, because we want to go on a tour. You just book your own tour. You just call people up. And be like, so you figure out a path. So, like, we're going to go through Arizona and then up through California and to Portland and come back home. And you would just keep calling people, like, can we please get a show in the city this night, you know? And you would just keep doing that. But at the time, it was easy for some reason, when I look back. But Jim, from Jimmy World, is one of the one of the people that was like, yeah, I want to show in Arizona. When I met him, he had like hair down to his ass. And, like, he was totally
awesome.
Different dude. But that's what you would do back then. You would just call people and then you'd jump in a van, you'd buy a van, put your gear in the back and you would just go, you know? And it was fun. I mean, it was a fun time, definitely. And then that's how we met those guys.
I think they slowed down because of you. I think they stopped being a punk band once they saw you guys.
It's possible because Jim was a really, really big fan. Jim loved us and I think he liked the fact that we were softer, you know. And because when we first met them, Tom was the lead singer, and that was, you know, it was a different band altogether. Not that it was bad, because I actually really like Tom's vocals, and like when they play live now, I love him. Tom sings. For some reason, like, there was some switch with the vocals, or like Jim, like, was more kind of like maybe listening. I don't know. I can't speculate on what they were thinking at the time, but I remember just all of a sudden Jim started singing and they just slowed down. Well, one thing they did do was like they were doing what we were doing, but better, you know, and we noticed it, you know, like, fuck, they're a little better than we are. A lot better. And then,
Did you meet the Boys Life? Or, I mean, if you saw another Jimmy Eat World thing, I mean, the same thing with Boys Life, like, same meeting up, was it the same, like, sending out a record and then...
No, Boys Life sent us a record. And, because we used to, like, at one point, all of our friends lived in this warehouse in downtown Denver where we would set up shows. And we would, I mean, like, basically, we just let... It was a warehouse that was, like, kind of set up already for shows, because whatever, like, older band in Denver, like, had, you know, this the generation before it set up, and they built a stage. And at one point, that scene just kind of burnt out, and, like, my friend Steve Revitt, I was in that band with Willow White Turnkey, he found that place, and he's like, well, this is a great warehouse, where, like, actually there was living spaces in it, so you could move into it. And there was a stage in the back, and we just started doing shows there. And it became, you know, it's got some word of mouth. And then one day we got a 7-inch by this band called Boys Life from Kansas. Like, we'd like to come play in Denver. We're like, whatever. Yeah, we'll throw you on the show. We'd never heard them. And I remember that night, actually, because everyone at the place was like, holy shit. These guys are really fucking good. I remember that, especially because the whole place, you know, was like, this band's so fucking good. And we just became friends at that point and decided, you know, like, we started playing shows together and, like, let's just go on tour together, you know, because then they heard us and we jived, you know. And it was just one of those. But they actually came to us and they were fantastic. Like, early Boys Life shows, that's one thing anyone who's into emo, the people who've never saw early Boys Life shows are missing a huge part of it, because that was one of the bands that was like, holy shit, but something's happening right now, you know, and it's really good. Because they have this, like, this weird dynamic of just being soft and loud and just blew people away. I mean, when you would see them live, you're like, you literally just like, I don't know what the fuck just happened, but I'm fucking, you know, like, I'm blown away right now. It's like being beat over, like, the head with a 2x4 when you saw them early on. Just unbelievable for you, you know. And to this day, I would love to go back in time and see them live again in that time period. You know, just fantastic. So, like, we became friends with them, and then they got hooked up with Crank. But that's another story, I mean, later on.
Yeah, I mean, well,
I don't want to keep talking.
No, I love, you know, come on. This is like, yeah. This is like emo gold. You know, I think, I mean, was when you saw Mineral for the first time, was that something, the same thing, where it was like a record, or was it you guys were in Austin? And
we were in Austin. We happened to play this, like, we were actually not in Austin, we were in Houston. There used to be the club Emos, there used to be one in Houston and one in Austin. And the Mineral thing was just a complete random thing, too. Like, we just happened to get booked on the same show. And not even, like, for any reason, you know, like, we didn't know each other. It just, we showed up to this club in Houston, because we were just doing one of those, like, in one of our weird little tours that we had set up. We were just getting the man and, like, lose money, basically. And, you know, because we were like 20 at the time, we didn't give a shit. And we show up to this club in Houston, and we start, you know, replaying. Like, they're like, there's this band actually called Mineral, and I remember just watching them, like, oh, wow. You know, like, what was that? And even, like, Carrie, like, we ended up putting out their first record, and, like, I mean, but they were just, there was another situation. But the funny thing about them was, like, they had nothing to do with the scene we were a part of. Like, they had this kid that they called a manager. You know, like, they're like, this is our manager, Jeff, or whatever his name was. And we're like, well, you guys have a manager? You know, like, what the fuck is this? You know, and, like, you're like, why do you guys need a manager? You're playing, like, shitty clubs in Houston. And they had no idea that, like, there was, like, this punk scene. They were really just like, we want to get a major label and do well. And I'm only speculating because at the time they seemed like they were just somewhere else. But we're like, there's this kind of scene that you guys don't know about. Like, you should go on tour with us because you guys are awesome. And sure enough, we took them on tour. And, like, every time we'd go out with them, like, people were just like, this band's amazing, you know. They just kind of, like, I think we helped them onto that, like, introducing them to the punk rock sort of, like, circuit, you know, that was, like, you know, the Book Your Own Fucking Life stuff and the Maximum Rock and Roll. But I remember, yeah, they were fucking awesome. Like, that was one of the only bands we played with, because we would play with the weirdest fucking band, you know, like, all the time. You just show up and, like, we'd play with bands that sound like, you know, the Crash Test Dummies and, like,
my God.
We'd get up. You know, it was like that all the time. But then Mineral was just like, man. And I remember Kerry, especially our, you know, the bass player. He was just like, I'm fucking starting a record label. The first record I'm doing is Mineral record, you know. And we actually released that first, or Kerry technically did it. That actually came out on Hopfield later. We were just like, we love this band, so we just go on tour with them. And sure enough, they got huge, because I knew that the people I knew were going to love them, you know, and they did, you know, and they got bigger than us eventually.
When you say huge, because like Tom was saying, like I was never able to see you guys play live. In your mind, like, what was huge back then, where it's like, you know, like,
That's funny you mentioned that, because, like, it really wasn't. Like, I mean, that was, like, if you can get, like, 100 people to show up to the show, you're huge, you know? Like,
okay.
It wasn't, like, you know, we were playing in people's living rooms and shit, you know? Like, a lot of our shows are in basements and just, like, whatever, like, they rented out a VFW hall. And, like, if you can get 100 people to a show, like, you were considered, like, big at the time, you know? Like, because we were completely tuned out of anything that was, like, pop culture. You know, like, it was, we just had this whole little, our own little scene. But you can tell, like, you know, if you had a bunch of kids with backpacks show up to your show, you know, with, like, you know, patches on them, and you knew you were doing well, you know, like, it was strange, you know. And that was with Chrissy Frontribe, you know, we got into that scene, and that's kind of where we were coming from. But it was all because of Heart Attack Magazine, too. Heart Attack Magazine was huge, like Instigator and all of that. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm familiar with Heart Attack, and obviously they helped, especially being from, like, I'm from Southern California, and so seeing how Heart Attack...
You're from California?
Yeah, I am from California, and seeing how Ebullition and Heart Attack, like, really helped develop that scene. I had no idea that they played a part in kind of developing the emo-ish stuff.
We would not be talking about Crazy French Ride right now if it wasn't for Heart Attack Magazine. There was no way, because we had this one good review in that magazine. We just happened, like, we would send a record out. Like, and the guy who put out, like, I have to give credit to, the guy who put our record out was this kid named Paul Kane from Denver, who was very into the punk scene. Like, he even got more crust, like, into crust punk later. But he would do everything by the book, punk rock. Like, we're selling shit for $4. So there's no, like, we're not fucking people over. I'm a huge fan of Kit McLeod. I mean, so we sent our record to Heart Attack, and we got this amazing review. We just happened to get to this one kid who was like, I love this record. Because it could have, like, that type of thing, it could get to the wrong kid, you know, like, when people are reviewing your record, like, they have like a few people reviewing. Like you have some kid who just wants to listen to nothing but hardcore. If you get your record, he's gonna be like, this sucks. You know, like it's so easy for that to happen. Because it's just, you know, because music's subjective, you know. So we have to get this one kid who's like, I love this record. And he wrote this, you know, just a beautiful review about it. And literally like a day later, everyone was calling us, you know, like, you guys have to play at our place. And after that, it was easy. And it was all because of that magazine, really. Because everything just turned. It was like that night and day. Because we went from playing in, we literally were playing in people's living rooms, like their friends. Like there'd be like 15 people there sitting on a couch watching us. I remember that happened in San Jose, California. We show up and like, so let's go to the show. And like, no, you're playing here in the living room. And it was just these, you know, 15 kids sitting on the couch looking at you like, yeah, you guys are okay. You know, like, that was the...
Yeah, that's so funny, because now it's like, you look at, you know, like a basis of comparison, like alternative press, like obviously that's like one of the largest music sort of publications that's around. And I could tell you for a fact that, you know, even if a band gets a glowing review in that, it's not like their career turns around like how you were able to kind of pinpoint that for Chris Seafront Drive.
Well, that scene too was it wasn't as big. And so like, it was a very small amount of people. But like, it was actually at the same time, like big, like when you really look at the whole country and like where it was reaching, it reached pretty far. Right? And there was a lot of kids with the same ideals at that time. And, you know, I don't know if I bought into the whole thing, you know, like, because we were always like, well, we happen to be doing well, but I didn't agree with all of it, because a lot of the kids seemed very like, I don't know, they were just not like posers, you know, like I felt like we got big at one point because people told people we were supposed to be good, you know, like if you got a good review in Heart Attack, then everyone thinks you're good, you know, like, and it's not like, it wasn't like everyone listened to the record was like, this is fantastic. I think a lot of people just like, oh, Heart Attack told me this is a good record. So yeah, it's a good record, you know? And which is weird with music. It's like that all the time, you know, like, and looking at Pitchfork is the complete, like, you know, realization of that idea. Like, records don't do well unless it gets to, like, this amazing Pitchfork review. But, you know, who gives a shit? Like, really, some one kid at Pitchfork loves this record, so it's going to get huge, you know? If you get a good review of Pitchfork, shit opens up. And I think maybe Pitchfork is, like, the Heart Attack of, you know, the corporate world in a weird way, you know? As if that makes sense.
Oh, that makes total sense. I hate Pitchfork.
Yeah.
Just personally. I agree. It's just this one review and one instance, and unless you and if you don't get it, you're forgotten about, and it's like, it's tough when I used to have bands ask, you know, oh, I want to get on Pitchfork, and I couldn't, you know, sometimes you couldn't even get a review, and they would just get bummed out, and
oh, yeah.
It's definitely hard.
I've been a part of, like, the worst, like, Antarctica got, like, one of the worst Pitchfork reviews ever. You know, like, it, like, got, like, a 2.1, and the guy was just like, fuck this record, you know, like, but he actually wrote it out like a story. Do you know the reviewer that, like, there was this one reviewer on Pitchfork that, like, actually went on to do movies, and he was, all of his reviews were, like, narratives.
Interesting.
Do you know who this kid is? Do you know what I'm talking about? Like,
no.
And he actually, like, ended up doing a couple, like, movies that, like, might have been, like, you know, kind of major motion pictures. And he would always, instead of writing a review, he'd write the story, like, me and my friend are walking down the street, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, it wouldn't be, we'd read it, and they're like, no, because the Antarctica review, we're reading it, we're like, what the fuck? Like, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. You know, like, I don't know if he likes it or doesn't like it. And by the end, then he was like, this record sucks. You know, like, it's a very last sentence, and we're like, fuck. And then, like, then he looked at the review, like, 2.6, damn. But he basically told us it was something like New Order, which is actually probably, that was the only true thing about the whole thing. We actually were, like, kind of on this, you know.
That's
we're
going to
play, like, new wave stuff. And, you know, for better or for worse, maybe we were one of the first bands who did that, you know, because that became big later. I don't think it's because of us. We just, you know, luckily we were like one of the first bands to like try to find like New Order or like Underworld. Or I remember showing up to like these emo shows, like, and we had all these keyboards set up. You know, like we had MIDI keyboards set up, and people were like, "Yeah, like you assholes, like what are you doing?" We also be like, "Oh, thanks for your friendship." There's so many shows that we can just see people looking at us heaving, you know, like, you suck. But then, like, 5 years later, it was, like, the big thing. I'm like, God damn it, I always miss the boat.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, that's the thing about, I mean, some of the bands that you were probably touring with toward the end. I mean, I wanted to get your take on some of the other bands you know, with Christy probably touring. I mean, Promise Ring, I know when we had chatted a few weeks ago, you were telling me that, you know, Davey was all about Duran Duran.
Oh, Davey, not even Davey, like, it was Scott Beshta, who was a bass player.
Oh, it was a bass player.
Like a huge, yeah, no, and that was the guy he eventually got, you know, that's the type of, I don't want to talk about that too much, because I don't know what happened with that situation. There was a lot of allegations, and which I thought were ridiculous, because I thought Scotty was just the greatest guy ever. But he was a big Duran Duran fan, and when we were on tour with him, he was always searching for, like, Duran Duran singles, and really, not that I didn't like them later, but like early on, the Promise Ring were just the shit when you saw them. Like they were so cool, you know. Like when you see them, like, this band is so fucking cool, you know. Like, and we did a couple of tours with them, and right before they recorded that first record, and they were just so great, you know. Like, and later, like, maybe I just wasn't like into what they were doing later on. And I probably would like it more if I listened to it now, because maybe they were just higher up on the echelon than I was. But, God, they were fantastic. Like, early on, like, I remember we played live with them. You're like, God, you didn't want to play after them. You know, they were just so great.
Yeah, I mean, just those tours. I mean, I know we've probably spoken about these tours. I mean, I saw Jimmy Eat World open for them. And it was, you know, that was, they were it. And on those tours, did you start seeing people sort of, because they were sort of the more poppy, the more, you know, really hook-laden, tight songs. It wasn't angular. It was really direct.
So they kind of came out of that, like, I remember playing this Detroit Fest. One of the first times we ever went to the whole East Coast, we ended up playing not in Detroit, but some weird city out of the skirts of Detroit, because the Detroit Fest was a big thing for a long time. And Livonia, Michigan, that's where it was. And you have bands like Still Life, and the first time we went there, Lifetime, I remember seeing Lifetime for the first time at that time period. They just have this, like, two-day fest, and we ended up playing with Captain Jazz, you know, like, and just sitting in this back room with them, like, and it was like they somehow paid all the bands through, like, how far they traveled, and so we got, like, for some reason, just coming from Denver, we got this shitload of money, and I remember, always to this day, I remember Davey being like, holy shit, getting up in the meeting, like, you guys are paying these guys $400, you know, and, he's like, well, I was like, I don't know, like, I have nothing to do with this, you know, like, but it was like this amazing thing. But then I feel like there was that scene. If you go to Chicago and like you know, the whole like Southern Illinois, or not, I don't know if it's Southern, but where it's Champaign, they had a whole another sound there. Like, there was kind of their own thing, and I never understood that sound. But Promise Ring was coming out of that, like Captain Jazz, which we went on further with like American Football and all this, man, that sound, because it almost seemed like it was like more like started by the Kentucky thing, like Slint and all those bands, and they had this whole other thing going on there that I just didn't understand. But like, it was cool though, like, you know, when you play those bands, like, who are you influenced by, you know? And Promise Ring was one of the first bands like that maybe were kind of influenced to me, like when I first time I heard them, I thought they were like kind of Sunday Day Real Estate-ish. But they also had like this weird Chicago, Kentucky thing going on that we didn't understand. I never was influenced by it. And so when we would play with them, I was like, oh, this is really cool. Like, I never, what a cool sound, you know, just kind of jangly pop. Not that Slint was jangly pop, but like something came out of that. Like, you know, those bands. There was a great band called Sweet to Lake Johnny. Do you guys know those guys?
I saw them a few times, actually. I never saw bands growing up in Vermont like this. They never came through unless they were a hardcore band, like Sick of It All. And Sweep the Leg Johnny came through, and I was blown away. I bought everything they had, and that was like, it was. Someone probably hasn't referenced that band in a very long time. And it's great that you mentioned them. Just that was that totally, you know, it was direct, but it was had a little curve to it that. I don't know if people haven't checked them out, definitely look them up.
They were one of those bands that like seemed to be on something that we weren't, you know, like that they were, you know, they knew something that we didn't know, and I don't think they'll never get the credit for it, but I think they started a lot of that angular like mass rock shit in kind of a way. Because I remember even meeting them, just like these are the weirdest dudes I've ever met.
And also, no one references math rock.
They told this amazing story about them being robbed. What?
I was just saying, no one mentions math rock anymore.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes it doesn't always go hand in hand with emo, but like, it kind of does in some ways. If you listen to like Polvo and bands like that, it mixes, you know. And a lot of those bands are usually bigger than the emo bands. So like, I think a lot of emo bands would like copy math rock because Slint. I remember once, when you were, like, in an emo band, or I don't even, I hate saying that because no one considered that at the time, but the bands, like, if you listen to, like, you know, Promise Ring and Us, everyone, like, we listen to bands like the Rachels and Fork and Abcarnation and Slint and stuff, and, like, be really influenced by it, and so, like, it seemed kind of cooler than what we were doing, you know? It was much bigger. I mean, when you first heard that first Slint, right, you know, or not the first one, but the Spiderland, you're just like, wow. You know, like, this is a whole other level of what we're doing in some way. I feel like a lot of people were like, copying, not copying, but, like, being influenced by it, especially in the Chicago region.
Yeah. What are you kind of, you know, pulling it back into the Chrissy Front Drive-ish type stuff? Because, I mean, obviously, since you guys only existed for a short period of time, is there a specific moment or two that kind of sticks out to you where it was like you kind of step back and were like, holy shit, like people are either getting us or like this is an amazing show that we played or, you know, something that kind of like made you really sort of, you know, be shocked at what you were doing?
I would say I think it's probably happened more now. So it still amazes me that people give a shit about us. At the time, we would play, yeah, because we really weren't greatly appreciated when we were around. I don't think, you know, it's not like we'd go and, like, we didn't have easy tours. Like, we would come home with, like, $400 extra and be super happy, you know. Maybe like, playing in Goleta because of the heart attack thing. There was one point where we played a show in Goleta, which I think Heart Attack was based out of that Santa Barbara, Goleta, California thing. We showed up, like 400 kids showed up to see us, and it was like, wow, like I've never, like I can't believe all these kids are here to see us today, you know. But it was just small stuff like that. I mean, but now it amazes me more that we're still talked about, you know, because it's not like we were, I don't really don't see us as being some like amazing band, you know. We just kind of were lucky enough to be part of some weird scene, being at the right place at the right time, you know. That amazes me more. Like, we're having this conversation right now amazes me, you know, like, that you even give a shit what I'm talking about.
There's
here.
A crazy guy that has a website. No, yeah. I think it is an interesting, I mean, time. I mean, the you got, you know, the Don't Forget to Breathe comp stuff. Just, you know, all those bands, Sunday's Best, Sunny Day, Captain Jazz, like you mentioned, just that scene kind of had this moment, and you guys were definitely there and part of it. And I think even just the Mineral Connection and obviously Jimmy Eat World, I mean, you're connected to these bands that sort of were out from it. And I think that's why.
Well, that's cool, yeah. It was a fun time. I mean, like, looking back, it was a lot of luck. And then we just happened to all run into each other. Maybe it wasn't luck. Maybe things are destined to be in some kind of weird way that, like, you know, certain scenes happen. Everyone just, there's certain, like, star stars align at one time period, and everyone was just seeing eye to eye for a little bit. And we had that feeling, though. Like, when we were on tour in that time period, it was just so much fun. It was just so much love, you know, like, when you're going around, you were just, like, sleep in people's houses, and they would cook you meals, and we would just basically jump in the van, and, like, you didn't have, it was like a free vacation, you know, like, if you just played music, you know, like, you would show up, and everyone knew each other, and, like, oh, and, you know, John in Chicago, and Seth in South Dakota, we all know each other. And it was like this weird connection between all these people that, like, really, like, deep down, and that's the one thing that doesn't, you know, I'm sure it happened today, because I'm not sure about, like, you know, whatever scenes are going on, but, like, everyone just cared about the music, and, like, and maybe there was a little, like, selfishness and, like, being in the scene, like, I'm punk rock, and I look like this, and I have a bag on, you know, there was, like, a little bit of that, because that's the funny thing, the funniest thing to me about punk rock is, like, everyone tries to be so, like, we're so outside of the establishment, and we're so different, but, like, they all act the same, like, when you're in, like, they're all the same kid when you go, like, you know, from town to town. But the one thing that was there was, like, a love of music, you know, and back then, you don't see much anymore. You know, like, when you would go and play, like, kids would almost start crying when you're playing, because they were just so connected to what you're doing, and that was the most amazing part. You know, I remember playing this show in Little Rock, Arkansas. This kid Matt, who ran File 13 Records for a while, and they had a friend of theirs that died in some car accident, and they just kind of, like, shut down the scene. And we played the first show when they finally decided to start doing shows again in Little Rock. And the room was just, like, all these kids who were, like, kind of remembering this you know, friend that died. I think he died of a car accident. It might have been a car accident. It might have been some kind of sickness, but either way, we're sitting in this room playing this show, and the kids are in tears. You know, and we're like, what the fuck is going on? Like, are these kids, like, crazy? But we realized later that, like, you know, it was like, it brought, this whole room was just brought together. Like, that's one thing a lot of bands will never feel when they're, like, big, you know, like, corporate bands. Like, you're sitting in this room, and, like, everyone is together in some weird way. It's like this kinship with everyone in the room. You're playing, and everyone's, it's an amazing feeling. Like, it's like, it almost brings you to tears when you're like, holy shit, why is everyone so into this show? And that's the way the scene was back then. Like, it was like this weird kinship with all these people across the country. Like, we all believe in the same thing. We're all against racism. We're all against fascism. And which, you know, which sounds, fascism sounds stupid. But it was like this, like, we felt like we were better than everyone, you know, in some way. Like, it was like, we got the way things worked that no one else did, you know. That the rest of the world was just like a bunch of robots, and we were just actually enjoying life. And no one else was, you know, and that was kind of cool, you know, that was a cool feeling, you know, the alienated people, you know.
Well, I think too, it kind of leads into, you know, if it's, you know, you guys had broke up, and then from that, from, you know, 97 on, it was sort of on for the things kind of broke.
Well,
I mean, I felt like it was, it definitely broke at some point, and it kind of took a different light.
Everything does. I mean, like, the problem is, when money is introduced, everything changes. You know, and that happens with any scene. Like, look at, I mean, Nirvana, like, any of those bands, like, once money is introduced, like, the ideals go to the wayside, you know, and not for, you know, I'm not blaming anyone for that, you know, like, but it takes, like, even take country music, you know, like, country music was a very important, like, very interesting, like, cultural phenomenon. But then once people start getting paid, it just turns into shit, you know? And that's the way everything happens, you know? Like, if even like maybe the Electro Clash scene in New York was kind of cool at one point. I don't know. I have no idea where those kids were coming from. But, like, once money is introduced, everything turns to shit for some reason, you know? Like, because you can't really, it's really hard to mix money and art, you know? Because once you mix it, I don't know what it is. It seems to, like, kill the art for some reason, in some odd way. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but
no, I think the scene, you know, there were bands that were, you started to see the buses, And you started to see sort of the complaining. You started to see the 15 merch designs. And it's not a problem that they're trying to make money off it. It just it started to get bigger. It started to have more people. The, you know, certain other groups of people started listening to it. So, yeah, I feel
it changed. It's the hard part of it because for me, like, I'm not trying to be like, I'm better than everyone else sort of thing. Like, because I actually think the way I think is probably like, I'm trying to think of ways without offending people, but I mean, it's probably hurt me more than helped me. That like, I hate when art turns into like a money making sort of like I know, and I just don't offend friends who have done it. You know, there's something about like when the two mix together, like there's something that the heart leaves somewhere, you know, it kind of drains, and then everyone's worrying about how much money they're making. And it's like when the bands would go to major labels, it's like, we just want to write some hits, we want to stay on this label, and we get this, like, and then, like, all of a sudden, like, what they were doing before, like, that was why people liked them in the first place, is gone. You know, like, is why you love Jawbreaker is because when you listen to the records, you're like, God, this fucking hit me so hard, you know, like, emotionally hit me. But then when they're, like, writing hits, you're like, well, it's not the songs are bad, but there's something about it. Like, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to put your finger on, because I think some people have pulled it off and done it both ways. But the problem is, I feel like a lot of labels go into scenes that have, like, this, you know, some heart to it, and they just rape it and, like, kill it in some way, you know? Like, we're going to start introducing money. And, like, most people will take money. I mean, like, no one's stupid, you know? Like, I would rather make money than not, you know? Like, I would like to, like, have money to buy records. But they take these kids who are, like, really doing it for the right reasons. And, like, once you start offering them money, like, it kind of gets killed in some way. It's a weird thing. Like, money has this weird ability just to kill heart in some way. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And I would have been just as, you know, I think I would have fallen for the same thing. I'm not saying I wouldn't have. If someone said, like, here's $1 million, I don't know what I would have done, you know?
Well, I think I wanted to bring up is, too, is, you know, you guys breaking up, you've got this time frame, and then the reunion in 07. What was the feeling coming back, playing that show? I saw some video of it. I mean, it looked like such a, you know, you guys were having fun. And what?
That was a blast, yeah. It was a punk rock, you know, like these really cool kids. And it kind of stemmed from that whole, like, I feel like one of our biggest fans and member was Jared from Planes, Mistaken for Stars. You know, like, he was like one of those kids that, like, saw us in Denver. His name's Jared, right? Am I getting the name wrong?
No, you're right.
But he was, like, part of that Denver scene, and it was kind of like the Denver Fest was kind of like a offshoot of, like, the Fest in Florida, Gainesville Fest, you know, no idea thing. And so, like, they would have another one, but they were like, we should have your friends got to play. So, like, we basically just kind of, we'll fly you out, just play the show. But it had this great feel of, like, you know, like, everyone was just, it was appreciative. No one was making money off of it. And, you know, like, we would just like to see you play these songs one more time, you know. Which actually ends up spurring us into playing more, because we end up realizing we love playing with each other, you know. But it was a blast. I mean, that show was amazing, you know. When you're sitting there playing with people, appreciate what you're doing. It was actually, like, we've never played a show like that where, like, people are just like, we're so excited to see you. Right? Besides Brooklyn, that was the other show that was, you know, that doesn't happen very often.
I mean, that end of the Brooklyn show, I mean, it was just to have those people there waiting and wanting to say hi and have these moments, and I was one of them, and I think that was such a beautiful thing, you know, to have that happen.
It was awesome. Yeah, we had a great time. I mean, when you can sit there and play music that you love and then, like, have, like, you know, these cool people in the crowd just, like, you know, just, like, they actually appreciate what you're doing and get it, it's a huge thing, because I mean, when you're playing, you can just feel it. It just felt like the old days when you're playing to these people and everyone's emotionally tied to each other.
And people were there from all of the time, like era. I mean, Texas, Reason was there. Guy from Boy's Life was there. It just it seemed like everyone kind of came out to the show, like we used to.
Well, I think we all love each other in some weird odd way, you know, like because we are all a part of something that like a lot of people weren't, you know. And you know, it's cool, you know, like that, and it's still appreciated, but like. It's almost like, you know, how celebrities become, and I'm not saying we're celebrities, I'm not saying that at all. I mean, I'm just saying, like, when you're a part of, it would be the same thing with, like, a boot camp. You become really close friends with someone in the boot camp, you know, like, because you went through the same thing, you know, like, we all had the same experience of, like, playing these shows in people's basements, and you know, there's a kinship there with that, you know, like, we were all together, and, like, for better or for worse, we just played these shows and had a great, you know, we was mostly better because we had such a great time, you know. So, because I didn't go to college, like, and I did a little college, but I mostly just went on tour, and, like, for me, it's almost like my college buddies in some way, you know. Like, when I see those people, like, the people that we, you know, we did these tours with and played with and hung out with, and it was like, that was my college friends for me, you know, in a lot of ways. But it was almost cooler than college because we were actually, like, doing something, you know, like we weren't paying our ass with the money to, you know, getting to some shitty job later, you know, like, I don't know. We were, like, actually, like, there was something we were doing that was kind of important at the time, you know. It felt, like, culturally important in some way.
And then you guys got to play, you know, Jimmy Eat World asked you guys to play on the Bleed American tour, which is, you know, that connection is still there. And was there anything fun from that trip that kind of stuck out? And this was a couple months ago, right? Or was it a month ago?
Yes. Yeah. It was just, we just did a home show in L.A. And it was fun. But, you know, at the same time, I realized we don't really mix with the Jimmy Eat World crowd. So you kind of just look at us like we were crazy. You know, it was one of like, this is our last show, and then, you know, a lot of clapping when we said that. But, like, there was a few kids. Yeah. And I was like, I know, it's our last, like, you guys want to watch Jimmy Eat World play. Which I don't blame them, because I've been to many shows, and you're like, I don't want to see the opening band. You know, like, and, like, you know, we remember that big, where, like, most people were like, holy shit, Chrissy Hunter's playing. You know, like, there's, like, you know, 20 people in each town and, like, give a shit about us, you know? So,
well, I was going to say, you guys should have played the Static Prevails tour, because then we're old enough where those kids would have got you, but the Bleed American tour is a lot of, you know, that was their crossover, so a lot of the fraternity kids in that era were out there, so maybe that was why. But that's funny if you're like, hey, so we got a couple more, and then everyone starts clapping. So.
Yeah. We didn't have that. We did, like, that night, we didn't have that at all. It was awkward, and I realize I hate playing on large stages. Like, it just doesn't. I like, when it comes down to it, when you're playing in, like, in a basement, and there's just people in front of you, and the place is just kind of moving together, those are, like, I love that, you know? Like, and they're sitting there, like, 10 feet above people, and they're just sitting there staring at you like you're crazy, and, you know, maybe, I'm sure it's different for Jimmy Eat World, you know, because they're just so loved, you know, like, maybe, like, even at that point, it would be enjoyable, but I hate it. I hate playing in large stages with, like, you know, like, a big sound, and it doesn't feel real to me in some way. It feels like I'm in some weird, like, in big lunches or something, and I'm up there, you know. There's nothing worse than having, like, 2,000 people sitting there staring at you like you're stupid, you know? It's horrible, you know? It's like a nightmare. And some people, you see some people getting into you playing, and, like, for the most part, you're just, like, people are staring at you like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Like, when is Jimmy Eat World coming in?
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's okay.
But it was fun, though. I mean, that trip to L.A. was amazing. I mean, I always love a trip somewhere, you know?
Totally. I mean, and just that connection was still there. I mean, they wanted you to play the show.
Wow.
They could have had anybody.
Yeah. The thing about Jimmy Eat World, like, as big as they've gotten, they're just, like, deep down, they're just good dudes. You know, like, they were never, like, I don't think they were ever, like, really bought into the punk rock thing that much. I think they really did want to be there where they are now. But, like, they're just, like, four regular guys. You know, like, they're not, like, rock star pricks, you know, like they're just like four guys who meet in Arizona in a bar somewhere, you know, and that's the cool thing about them, and that's why I've always been happy that they've been big, because like I can't see a bad thing about any of them, you know, like they're just some good, you know, good people, you know, and they just, they're lucky to be where they are. They don't take it too seriously, and they're just good guys, you know, like, and plus just phenomenal songwriters, you know, like, I mean, those records are really good, you know, like, and they don't take it too seriously, and they're cool dudes, you know, even when you see them now, they're great guys, like, you know, like, I'm sitting there drinking whiskey, like, Rick, the bass player, like, makes his own whiskey now, and you're sitting there, like, just getting drunk with him on his own whiskey and stuff, you're like, you guys are fantastic, you know, they're actually doing the right thing, they're just enjoying it, you know. Because they know, like, they realize where they are. Like, they know they could go away at any time. And they're just like, we're really fucking lucky. And, like, we're just enjoying it, you know?
That's awesome. Well, for you guys, I mean, for you, is it, I mean, you've had a bunch of bands after, and you're obviously still wanting to make music. And is that still a passion that you still want to do? And will there be more Christy Front Drive shows? Or?
Not really Christy Front Drive, but, like, I write music constantly. I mean, I'm one of those people that has a song in my head at all times. You know, like, when I wake up in the morning, I've heard this explained to other people before, but I have, like, a radio station in my head, like, at all times. And I just heard that recently because I was listening to this interview with Howard Stern and whatever the lead singer of Coldplay's name is, you know.
Chris Martin.
And there is one thing that people who write songs, you really do have, like, this radio station on in your head all the time that, like, you just keep hearing music. Like, when I wake up in the morning, there's usually music going on in my head. And, you know, unfortunately, my songs haven't made $1 million. I have these, like, piece of shit songs that do nothing. But at the same time, I have to keep writing, and I have to get them out of my head in some way, because it really is aggravating. You know, like, it's almost like maybe having some kind of, like, a disability in some weird way. So, like, I get up and, like, I have to write songs, you know? And so to this point, I need to keep writing in some way. And I'm hoping at one point that I actually do something great, you know? Like, Crazy Punch, you know, like, I'm really appreciative it's done well, but I still feel like I have something great in me, maybe. You know, that I would like to die. When I die, I would like to, like, have one of those records that you're like, this record was fucking awesome. You know, like, it was, you know, it changed, you know, something. You know, I mean, Christy Front Drive was just, you know, it was cool, but I still feel like I might have something better in me. And I'm going to keep striving to that until I die, I think, because I have to.
Well,
you know?
I think that's a great way of looking at it, and that's really poignant. I think that's awesome. Like, that's actually something I tell every band when I go up to them. I used to be able to get a radio ID because I worked at a college radio station. That was my way to talk to them for 5 seconds. But now it's, if I do get a moment and I feel like I need to say something, it's keep playing music. Like, I remember telling Chris Simpson that from when I saw him with Zookeeper. I just said, I love your stuff. Can you just keep making music? Because people like it.
He's amazing at it. But it goes with any profession. Like, there's people who write, there's people who are teachers, there's people, and, like, they all have, like, if you have this feeling like you can do something great, like, in writers, like, it happens more in arts, maybe. Because I mean, you know, with teaching, because I'm not really a teacher per se, even though, like, I teach, but there's teachers who are, like, have this great feeling of, like, I'm going to do something, I'm going to really change some people's lives. And if you have that feeling, you got to keep doing it, you know, like, or, you know, anyone who writes, you know, because I know Tom, like, writes a lot, and, like, it's just, like, I'm sure everyone who does it passionately is, like, I have something great in me, you know, and, like, you have to keep doing it until you feel like you've reached whatever that is that's great in you, and it happens, and no matter what you're good at, like, if you're a mathematician, like, I'm going to solve, you know, the, you know, when they solve, like, what was that whole thing with the donut, with the, they somehow, there's something with mathematicians, they're always trying to figure out the equation of a donut because of, like, the roundness, and, like, and some guy dedicated his whole life to it, you know, and actually went crazy from it, you know, and, like, you know, no matter what you have to find something you love and just try to be as good as you can at it, you know. I think that's one of the most important things in life, you know. You got to find some kind of, it's like the Joseph Campbell, find your bliss, but try to do it great, you know, in some kind of way. and I'm still chasing that, you know, in some ways. I would like to die and be like, someone said that, you know, the greatest thing ever, you know.
I love that.